You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. When you hear about Gates Foundation or the Mott Foundation or Kresge, Skillman, Donnelly, Hudson, how do you describe what those philanthropic organizations do? I mean, is it just give money? Does it solve problems? Are they improving conditions? Is there a downside to throwing money at problems or wielding influence with cash? Megan Tompkins-Stang has written a book that examines some of that in regards to education. The book is Policy Patrons, Philanthropy, Education Reform, and the Politics of Influence. You decided you'd narrow your research down to four among the 20 largest foundations. Which ones did you choose and why?
The ones I chose were the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, which is comparatively smaller amongst the four. It only has a $2 billion endowment compared to, you know, Gates' $30 or $60 billion endowment now, Kellogg and Ford. And I chose those four because they are all in the top 20 of the largest foundations nationally that invest in education context. And I wanted to look at mega foundations.
And I should say, in interest of full disclosure, Michigan Radio receives grants for various projects from two of those foundations, Kellogg and Ford. In fact, part of my salary comes from one of them. So there's that. Now, every foundation has a set of goals, things they identify as needing support, whether it's health or art or poverty issues. You looked at education. How they approach those issues, how they frame their way of helping differs a lot. How does that play out?
So in the book, I kind of introduce a framework and the difference between those two approaches I describe as outcome-oriented versus field-oriented. Where an outcome-oriented approach, which is exemplified by Gates and Broad, is more strategic in nature. The foundations identify a particular goal. They marshal all the resources towards that goal. They will kind of find like-minded partners as grantees, and they'll hold those grantees accountable to very specific metrics. The field-oriented approach, which is more exemplified by Kellogg and Ford, is a very different in that there's not a specific policy goal that's set at the foundation level. Instead, they tend to give grants to organizations in a space they think are doing really good work and let the grantees decide more for themselves with less control at the locus of the foundation.
So why does approach matter? Those two approaches you just described, does it really matter? And does it have an effect that an unintended consequence?
I argue that it has a huge effect and consequence. In the case of Gates, is I think where we're seeing the most relevant and timely illustration of that. You know, Gates is very, very almost technocratic in the way it handles its grant making. It wants to get into an open policy window very quickly and be able to move quickly policy, often in partnering with elites and public officials. And so this manifested itself in terms of their support of the Common Core, which, as you may know, was recently dismantled with the ESSA, passage of the ESSA. But they were really behind that starting in, you know, 2008, 2009. They were getting all the governors on board behind the scenes, getting them to sign on to a common sort of compact that they would pursue, you know, common standards across states. What they didn't do is a political strategy wherein they were really bringing in the opinions and the ideas of students, parents, teachers, school district leaders. And I think we've seen now that that has backfired on them a little bit because there was such a mass uprising against the core, this very top-down, elite, almost expert-driven strategy at the expense of a more democratic strategy, I think caused them to win the sprint but lose the marathon, if you will.
I had a conversation about something like this with some folks at Kresge, basically saying, you know, coming up with a solution and then imposing it sometimes is not the best approach. Do we see a lot of those kinds of things happening?
Very much so. And especially at Gates and Broad, it is much more of a top-down directive approach. And in a strategic philanthropy mindset, wherein you're really going towards a goal, you have to be more directive. You can't rely on a number of otherwise uncoordinated groups to do that. So it makes sense that they would do that given that mindset. But it often resulted in what others perceived as hubris, what others perceived as kind of a lack of respect towards the people that they were making programs and policy that was intended to influence. And then there was an ownership. And I think the first part that you learn in terms of institutional change is that you have to get people on board and take ownership over the policy reforms that you're trying to get passed. You can't just do it from the top down.
Lately, we've been seeing foundations teaming up on projects. The grand bargain to save the Detroit Institute of Arts Museum and the retiree pensions during Detroit's bankruptcy is a major example in this area. With several foundations working together, we're talking about even more clout. Why is this trend happening?
Well, I think several reasons. I think the first is foundations realize that their endowments compared to state coffers are still a drop in the bucket. So by teaming up with other types of foundations that are pursuing similar goals, they may have more impact or more leverage, if you will, and including political capital, not just financial resources. I do think it has a downside in that, you know, foundations ostensibly also exist to kind of facilitate pluralism in civil society, to support a wide variety of different approaches and views. And when all the foundations are supporting one thing, that creates the danger that alternative viewpoints are crowded out and don't get heard.
Because of the political decisions to make government as small as possible and continue to cut at every level of government, we've been seeing these philanthropists step in. Let me give you an example. In Kalamazoo, the city is wrestling with the best way to handle a potential $70 million gift. There's been a fair amount written about that. A lot of it's been pretty skeptical. Most recently, the Free Press editorial writer Nancy Kaffer encouraged people to be skeptical when private money is doing something that government traditionally does because it diminishes the people's will, the voters' influence over how to spend that money. Your book seems to suggest that as well. How do we hold foundations more accountable for their social experiments or stepping in, filling in government's shoes?
I think that's the, you know, the $100 million question that everyone is talking about right now.
Especially, or $100 billion at this point.
$100 billion, $100 trillion. Especially in cities like Detroit, cities like Kalamazoo, cities in the Rust Belt where we're seeing significant population exit, less tax base, sometimes not even able to support public services to the degree that they can. So, I mean, if you were a mayor in one of those cities, of course, it would seem like a no-brainer to accept this large amount of money when you're out of options. That said, I think we need to treat very carefully the suggestion that private foundations can, or private philanthropists, not part of a foundation, could step in for any long-term service provision, both because they'll run out of money, right? They don't have as much money as the state, but also because it affords them more control than I think is democratically wise. I think, especially in the field of education, you know, it's an unequivocally democratically governed institution, and yet it's also the most philanthropically saturated. And you see all these debates about, you know, foundations coming in and dictating what policies will happen with regard to charter schools or what have you. So I'd say the downsides actually outweigh the short term in terms of loss of public voice and public control over private money. You know, strings are attached to donations, and, you know, would you give your money without strings in a failing city? It's hard to say.
I want to ask you one final question. You are not unfamiliar with foundations. You used to work for one. You talked to a lot of, and I will note, unnamed sources within foundations for your book. So having that familiarity, what did you learn?
That's a great question. I mean, I honestly learned so much. You know, it's packaged, the book is packaged in this nice little framework where these foundations do these two different things. But going into the project, I really knew nothing about how these foundations worked. You know, they're so closed and they're so secretive, and it's so rare to get any access at all as a researcher. And so I was really surprised at how these four foundations, all of which are, you know, have an excess of $1 billion of endowment. They're huge. They're really, really active in policy. I was so interested to see how differently they came at policy influence. You know, one very top down, one more almost grassroots oriented, and to see kind of how that played out in the effects that they had, the outcomes they had as well.
Megan Tompkins-Stang is the author of Policy Patrons, Philanthropy, Education, Reform, and the Politics of Influence, also an assistant professor at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.